You're listening to the programme Saskia Unreserved on RIC Classic. Now we move over to London to speak to the composer and conductor Nimrod Borenstein. In the past few years, we've seen a great number of Nimrod's works being commissioned, recorded, premiered at the most prestigious venues and festivals across the globe, from the Royal Festival Hall and the Royal Opera House in London to the Salle Gavor in Paris, Carnegie Hall in New York, Hong Kong City Hall, with his music performed regularly throughout Europe, Canada, Australia, the Far East, Israel, South America, Russia, and the USA. And in recent years, he's been commissioned to write the obligatory performance pieces for the Hong Kong International Piano Competition and the International Jeunesse Musicale Competition for Cello in 2020. A very warm welcome to the program, Nimrod. Great to have you with me.
Yes, hello. I would say good morning because it's morning for me, but for you it's just afternoon.
It's just gone lunchtime, and wonderful to speak to you. I'd like to ask by saying, could you recount your first musical experience, because it was quite special?
I know it only from my parents, because there's no way that I can remember what it was when I was 3 years old.
Yes.
But apparently, we were on a holiday in France, in the Black Forest, which is between France and Germany, near Colmar, we were going on a walk, and when we came back from the walk, there was a concert outside with an orchestra, because it was the summer, and I just couldn't move from there. I loved it, and I was just a few months before being three. And I stayed all the concerts, so we are talking about an hour and a half, full symphony concert. And after I announced I wanted to be a musician. And my parents thought, oh, that's nice. And they didn't take it very seriously, even if my dad is an artist.
Yes.
And, we came back to Paris, where I lived at that time. My dad recalled the story to his own mom, my grandmother. And she said to him, shame on you, you are an artist. If he wants to be a musician, give him lessons. And it's how it started when I was three.
And you began with a piano?
No, actually, I started in France. You have a few months of doing just music theory before you start.
Yes.
So there were these few months where I advanced quite quickly, and then there was piano and violin, yes.
The love for composition, was it there from the very beginning?
I think that composition comes from the love of existing music, or at least it should. In a way, I had this interesting discussion with my daughter that now is 20 and is studying philosophy, and she's a writer, and my dad that is an artist. And I think that we all, sort of, whether it's big scientific discoveries, you know, talking Einstein, Newton, or it's in art, with Mozart, Bach, Brahms, whoever, we always are built on the past. If we are bad composers, or then we are academic and we don't build on the past, we sort of rely on the past, which is different. But I think it's the past that inspires us. So often, to come back to your question, I started to learn music when I was three. And by the time I was six, I could, I had really good teaching in front for that. I could read and write in all clefs, so I could read orchestra scores. And then I started to write. And I was 6 years old. But the writing, I think, and that's, I think it's very important for you, if there are some young composers listening to your program, I think that the composing shouldn't be taught to start with. Because the most important thing is to find your own voice, and even if you're not going to find your own voice when you are six, but the less is done, the better, in a way. The best teachers are better than Brahms, Stravinsky, Shostakovich, but not direct teachers.
Yes. Can you talk to us a little about identity and composition and the role that it actually plays for you?
For me, I think that I've always sort of, from when I started to compose when I was six, I wanted to be like Beethoven or Bach, but not in the sense write music that sounded like them, but to be as great. And there's something pure, and I think that it's for me it's just a matter of looking for perfection or for it's you know it's difficult because it's all philosophical questions and I'm not a philosopher. I do it. Sort of it's something that I do, but I do consciously. I try to do something that is. I think that taste and quality is something that you develop, that
yes.
you strive all the time. Mm-hmm. But I think that I try to create a new world that is beautiful. But I think that beautiful not in a sort of a nice little song necessarily.
Yes.
Way, but something that creates something that didn't exist. You know, it's like you listen to Schumann a few notes on Yanni's world. Without Schumann, this world wouldn't exist. It's a world that is created, and I think it's why we use the word creation for all art. Like we talk about God created the it's whether you are someone that is a believer or not.
Mm.
There's this part of that I think important to create something new, and you of course there's something new. I think it's not enough because you can have something that is new but totally uninteresting. But having said that, it's not that often. The things that are not interesting tend to be not be new as well. So, but I've done it now for more than 40 years.
Do you like to give your music a national identity?
No, I think that it is for me. It's very very important. But I think that it's we've gone away from that in the 19th century where we were very racist, and maybe we are coming back to that. But I think it's a mistake. I think that it's human beings are quite naturally tribal and racist. So I think that we shouldn't push it more toward that. Mm. I think that in a way, human beings are equal in the most important part of them. And of course, you've got multiple identities, but the humanity is the most important part. It's why, sort of, also, it's not only in nationality, but also in time. You read Plato now, or things that have been written 2,000 years ago, and it feels like it's today.
Yes.
Because, sort of, our feelings as human beings don't change that much. So I think that I'm not denying that we've got our particularity, that each person is made of lots of things, but I think that you are naturally, so you don't need to push it. It's artificial. Sort of in a way, I imagine that sort of when you listen to the music of Mozart, part of it is the man Mozart himself, made of all his experiences and his culture, and his, but it's not something conscious. I think that you can choose also, I think that we've got the freedom to choose who are our gods or examples. For me, it was just when I was young and in my formation years. It still is, but the German school or German or Austrian school of so Bach, Mozart, Beethoven. But on the other hand, I really liked all the things that are more like Stravinsky, which is more Russian school. But I think that for me, the most important thing is the quality.
Yes.
And I would. I think that when we are. That certain things should happen naturally. That whether we want it or we don't want it, we are who we are.
Yes.
And it will transpire in what we do, anything that we do.
Mm. What do you think are important personality traits of a composer? I see you as a leader and someone who thrives on influencing and persuading others.
I think that's something that you should ask my daughter, but having said that, or my wife, but I think that for me, it's there is something that is extreme in the personality of an artist in general, in the sense that it's totally uncompromising. And I think that that's the thing that is the most important, that you don't... there is nothing that I... you could give me millions, I wouldn't write what I don't consider to be good. So there is a moral
yes.
aspect, but a moral aspect...
Ethical,
of,
maybe, rather than moral?
Ethical, but but in the art itself, because otherwise it would be difficult to understand. You say, well, but look at people like Wagner, they were terrible person, and they were not moral or not ethical. But it's not entirely exact. They were not moral in the human interactions or all the things, but they were moral in their art. And which it might not be nice, but it's the most important thing for that. I think that for myself, I think that it's not enough, and I think that it's important to be a good person as well.
Yes.
But it's nothing to do with art. You can be a bad person and a good composer, or you can be not a composer and a good person. It's not related.
Mm. Who has been the most significant influence on your musical life?
It's a difficult thing to answer properly. I would probably answer that it was my father. That he is a great artist, and that sort of shaped who I became as a human being and as an artist. He's a really very smiley person and very, very nice, but he's totally uncompromising in his art. And he passed that to me. But it's not a direct thing, because he could... I think that... but also we had sort of certain abstract discussion together. It's... I think that probably the influences that are musical influences will be with some dead people. Sort of, I would say that I was very influenced by all the great composers, that the one that I like. So from Bach to Mozart to Beethoven to people like Shostakovich or Prokofiev or Messiaen, or it doesn't matter. But they've been my teachers when I was young.
Yes. Can you talk to us a little about the process of writing? And is there a difference for you in approach? You have a lot of commissions when you do a commission as opposed to writing your own work.
No, it's the same. Because I would just never do something for money. So so I write what I think. It's and I'm very, very cautious in... my wife would say too cautious. I'm never late. So we go on holidays, so then we'll arrive to the airport 3 hours before. But I do that also in my work. So it means that I...
I think that's called disciplined.
Yes, probably that's what I like to call it.
Yes, I agree with
that. Other words for that.
100%. I'm usually packed for my holidays as well, a month in advance.
I don't find a difference. I think that I tried to do the best that I can, and it's not enough. I think that actually I don't try to do the best. I think that if the best is not enough, it's not good enough for me. I want to arrive to that perfection, and I don't care what the cost for me.
How do you keep evolving in your writing and enlarging your musical palette?
This is an interesting question. Actually, sort of, it's when you are, a young composer, I think the most important thing for any artist is to have his own voice. And that's above everything else. And a true voice, because some people these days call themselves avant-garde, and they all do the same. So how can you be avant-garde if you all do the same? It doesn't make any sense, intellectually. So, but it means that nobody else is doing what you're doing, really, truly. And that's sort of when you are in your... I remember consciously trying for that from the beginning, from age 6, but especially when you are 18 or 20, that's what you are fighting for. But as you are getting older, there is another aspect that arises when you are, let's say, over 45 or something like that, that you don't want to repeat yourself.
Yes.
Which is another difficulty. And I think that you've got to accept that, in a way, sort of the fact that you can... Any very, very great composer, well, be it sort of like we are talking Schumann or Stravinsky, you recognize their style after 3 or 4 notes, even at any period of their life. It means that in some way there is something that is common, and that you create only something, one thing, in essence, but you can evolve in some some way, and you, like you say, you develop your palate.
Yes.
And you strive consciously. I think that it's happening sort of as a game of will, that you really try to find new ways. And also, I think that we are very human beings are very easily bored. So that helps us.
Yes.
So that you don't want to repeat the same thing because it's boring for yourself.
How do you select the people whom you write for?
That's an interesting question. I think that it's like, I find that it's a bit like in love. So that if you are, in general, if you love someone, I mean also in friendship, a general term of love, let's say, they tend to love you back. If it's true, if it's not a fancy, because it means that you got something really in common. Mm-hmm. I think it's true also for in music that actually that's how I met Ashkenazi for the first time. I really liked for many years how he played, and once I saw him on TV and he was giving an interview about they were asking him about Shostakovich or something like that, and he said a few words, and I thought, oh, I'm completely sure he's going to like my music. I must meet him. And it worked that way as well. But I think that it's not unusual, sort of, that if you are, you try to be with people that you respect, and so that actually sort of a lot of, it's true that my career in that sense has been very different from maybe other composers. I think, is that you've got people that have done their careers through the usual channels that are sort of, they've been commissioned works from established things, so from the establishment in a way, and then the work is given to some people that will play it. But I think that because my music was very different and very new, from the start I had problems getting it played because the establishment didn't quite like it, they didn't like what I was doing. And so my career has always been through musicians that liked my music and decided to play it.
This is something that you've actually said before, that all composers need artists to perform their music. And you were lucky that you had Vladimir Ashkenazi taking an interest early on. Do you think that that collaboration helped? And what advice would you give in this regard to other young composers? Would you say find some artists whom you like, whom you admire, whose ethics, morals can align yourself with, and ask them to be part of your journey?
I think that depends for what age of composers you are asking. I think that if you are thinking about career when you are young, then you are not going to be anything. I think that it should be only, you should be desperate to write great music, and that should be it. And I was very, very naive when I was 15 or 20. The only thing that mattered to me was to write music that I would consider as good as Beethoven. And anything else was not of no importance, truly. And so all this idea of you need to meet that to advance your career, I think it's for later in some way. But then I would say that that it should be natural. It should be true. As well, it should be someone that you shouldn't say, okay, I'm going to contact this person because they are very well known and they're going to advance my career. I think that, well, I find it sort of problematic as a human being. I can't do that. It's not a moral judgment. I just don't like it, so I wouldn't do it.
Yes.
But I think that there are two different things for me, because it's true that that Ashkenazi and all the sort of important music figures have helped my career. But I think on the other hand, there's that, and there is the big quantity of musicians that are not as well known, but have always that have grown. Sort of, I think now I've got more than 2,000 musicians, individuals that have played my music, and I don't count people in orchestra, because then we wouldn't be
yes,
more.
Yes.
But people that have played it in chamber music, that have decided to do it for themselves and without knowing me. And gradually we became friends. You can't have 22,000 close friends, but there are people that that I've got something that I they are friends in some way, because music makes you very close.
Yes.
And they've been sort of, I think that now that I'm at my age, there are really over 2,000 people like that, and they, I think they count as much as Ashkenazi in the real success. That in a way, you know, when you always have, it's not a final answer, but you know, you look at lives of all great composers, and often during their lifetime, it's difficult. Some have been very, very unlucky, like Schubert, and that three-quarter of his music was not played. And others were. I think if you live long enough, you have more chances. Dying at 32 is not a good idea. But you would say sort of, how is it that in general it's difficult for real great composers to have big recognition during their lifetime, and then after they die, eventually there seems to be almost a justice happening. And I think the explanation is that by then, people that maybe have succeeded during their lifetime because they had the right connections, or, you know, then it doesn't matter. We all die and we are nothing. The only thing that is left is the music itself. And then people decide to play it if they like it. It's got nothing to do with anything else. So I think that even in as a composer in your lifetime, if people do it like that, it's there's more chances that your music will survive also when you're not there anymore.
Mm. Technology continues to drive us forward. What do you use to help in your writing, in the notation, in the orchestration?
Nothing. I think that in that sense, for me, you know, technology, I love technology. I was very good in mathematics when I was young, and so I'm not against technology, but I think that it's that when you, it's got a role, but it's like, you know, music instruments. They are instruments. They are a vehicle for something else. And so is technology. When you think about that 2,000 years ago, the Greeks figured out that the world was made of atoms without any technology, but because they had just great thinkers and they could figure out the distance between the Earth and the Moon. So you, that, I think, gives us an example of how little technology changes for certain things.
Yes.
It changes our lives. But for me, you know, when I was young, in France, you've got this... That's a funny story. I don't know if I told you before. In France, when I don't know if it's still like that now, but it used to be that you were sort of really pushed to compose entirely in your head without the help of a piano or anything. So it's trained. You're trained for that, which is very good. But you're also sort of quite extreme with that. And I remember that when I was about 17. There was a great teacher at, I can't remember if it's Yale or Harvard, that came to see me because somebody had told him that I was a genius, he needed to listen. And he came, and I was at home, and he asked me, can you show me what you've written? And then he asked me, sort of, do you compose at the piano? And for me, it was like an insult, because I had been... So I said, sort of, no, of course not. And he laughed, because he was maybe 50.
Yes.
And he told me, you know, there's this funny story about Stravinsky when he lived in Paris. So Stravinsky usually composed at the piano. And he came to live in Paris for a few years, or I don't know for how long, I can't remember. And he rented a flat that was duplex, so there were two floors, because he would hide the fact that he was composing at the piano. So after that, sort of, I thought it was really funny, but it's... But I still compose in my head because I got used to it, and I feel that it's easier.
Yes.
In a way, because you are not, there is a limit of, and I don't like, I'm lucky I've never had any surprises in terms of what comes in the when the music is played and what is in my head.
Yes, it sounds the same.
I can imagine it. Exactly, it sounds the same. So I think that in that sense, composing in my head rather than on the piano helps, because if you imagine the sound of oboe, it's not the same sound as the sound of the piano.
Yes,
of course. So you might as well, if you can, you might as well do it like that.
Media and public broadcasters are often criticized for not giving sufficient airtime to young composers or contemporary music. Why do you think this is, And how can this be improved? What would you like to see happening in the next few years?
I'm going to give an answer that is very unusual. I'll say that our contemporary music deserves what is happening to it. We've done sort of ridiculous things for 40 years. I mean, music that was just noises, crack, that's supposed to be intelligent, but actually is very stupid, and that has pushed away the audience that they expect that. It's true, on the other hand, that I think that at any given time, 99% of the new music will be rubbish. It doesn't matter if it's in Schumann's time or now's time. What will not be rubbish will be what will stay, but it's a small percentage. And I think that if I say 1%, I'm quite optimistic.
So you think that only 1% of contemporary music is actually going to last the way the music of Bach and Beethoven and Mozart has survived?
Oh, that's the best case scenario. That by a long way.
Wow.
Because the music of Bach was 1% during his lifetime, or maybe even less. There were more than 100 composers living and creating during the time of Bach, and it's only Bach that stays. So it's just as a percentage.
Yes.
It's just you cannot. But I think that also because of that, I'm not for festivals that are just contemporary music, because anyone that is sane, as an audience, will know that 99% will be bad. It's just a statistic. And also for the composer himself, I like to have my pieces played against pieces that are very great and see if it stands it. Because if my music is played after Brahms and it's good enough, then that's the real test.
Wow.
That's the only test. I know that it's not true, but it's what it's felt. I have many concerts. I think it's a few weeks ago I had my oboe concerto that was premiered in Belgrade with the Belgrade Philharmonic. And there was a piece, I think, Ravel, that opened the concert. And a lot of people after the concert came to say to me, that my piece was better than Ravel. I know that's not true, because it's a beautiful piece by Ravel. I don't think that it's less good, but I don't think that it's better, because I don't think it's possible to be better. But for them, it was new. It's the difference between, and they were not expecting it. And you read again a book that you really loved, you read it again, and you have a pleasure, but you read a book that you've never read, and if you like it, there's something exciting.
Nimrod, yes, sorry. Yes. Go ahead.
I think that about the broadcasters, I think that in a way the press, it's like, I think that the role of the press, it's like for politics. The press is a witness of what's happening. And so it should show what is happening. Like sort of if you read a newspaper or you listen to the radio and you want to know what's happening in a certain country or you are curious to know, they should say it. And it's the same, but I don't think that necessarily as an instigator that it's the role of the press. I'm not sure, I don't have more weight as a human being than somebody else in that, but I think that it's too much. We are not in a communist country where everything is dictated from the top. The real role where the state should put a lot of effort is education, because sort of if you give a chance to people to hear great music and so that when they come out of school they know that it exists, then you'll have more people in the concert hall, and if there are more people in the concert hall, there will be more people that are interested to hear from the press what's happening in the concert hall. But the press should be a witness of The origin for me is somewhere else.
Yes. Quality is, of course, a very subjective word. But what do you think that it is that makes the composer stand out and be noticed? For example, with your music, there's an incredible amount of thought behind it. One can hear that even from the very outset. There's rhythmic, there's melodic line, there's construct, there's structure. Do you think that there are too many composers who are just going for effects in order to be different because so much has been done, or they don't have that technical facility, or maybe even, can I say, talent, because not everybody can be talented?
I think that it's a mystery, you know, sort of in a way. I think that it's when I give composition lessons, which I do for, they often are people that are professional musicians, and very good performers as well. But one of my first lessons is I give the first page of the Beethoven First Piano Sonata, on the first page of the Hummel Piano Sonata, and I ask, why is Beethoven greater, or why Hummel is not so good? It's very, very easy to pinpoint why something is not great, or because it's too symmetrical, because it's too predictable. And in a way, it's because it's done according to a recipe. Great art, it's not. It's as difficult now to sit in front of the white page for me as it was 50 years ago or 45 years ago. And it's on the first few notes, the real, what is very, very, the most important things do not have tricks. They are difficult to get you. It's true that you use your intellect to help you build them, but it's the intuition that that creates them. You know, it's like, say, I think that the scientists would probably correct me, but that they are trying to build computers these days that are more like the human brain with the quantum computers, because computers can do operations that that we do thousands of times faster or better in some way, but they don't have the what human brains have, is to do random associations, which maybe are not so random, and that are the real creativity and on intelligence. And it's, but what we say, we put a word talent, is I used to be very, very convinced that, I still am, that in a way, when I hear someone talk about creating music, I can often know if the music is to be good, because the people that create a music that is boring are very, are capable of explaining what they are doing.
Yes.
And if it's that simple, it cannot be that good.
Yes, it needs complexity. Do you revisit any of your works and say, for example, after a performance, I would have liked to change that now, 5 years down the line? In hindsight, I see that I would like to change this.
No, actually, it's not something that is ideological. It's just it's an honest answer. I sort of tend to spend a long, long time trying to get to what I feel is the only answer. I remember I've used it for many, many times. So now maybe I'm starting to sound like an old man. That this is when I was in my teens, the film Amadeus came out, and there is this beautiful moment when Mozart is told by the prince to change something, and he said that there is exactly the right amount of notes, not one less or one.
Yes.
And for me, great art is about that, finding the right balance. But what's interesting, and I think that that explains what you take, for example, let's take Mozart, and there are some works that are great and amazing, and there are some works that are less great, because they are not all great. And the only explanation that you could say is that it's not that if you had worked longer on that, works, they would have been better, because that's the maximum that they can give.
Yes.
But maybe it's where you have no, it's exactly that, it's a white page, the first 30 seconds of the piece. If the first 30 seconds of the piece are out of this world, and you are a great composer, the rest of the piece will be like that.
Mm.
But if the first 30 seconds are okay, but not amazing, so you'll do the best to create the best thing with that. And, of course, when you are doing it, you are maybe not conscious of it, because otherwise you would put the piece in the bin and bye-bye. And maybe you are, with distance, you can see that maybe that piece is not as great as another one. But it's not that you can change anything. It's that that I was going to say who is that piece, but it's in that sense. So I think that I had a few years ago. I was having a breakfast with a pianist, a young Russian pianist, and she told me something that shocked me. She said, "You know, I think you are now. It's like that there was a golden age for Schumann for 10 years that you wrote just masterpiece. I think it's your golden age." It's sort of scared me.
Yes.
Because, you know, so it's not all these type of things that might scare it. But I couldn't escape thinking about it. And I had, and I'm quite analytical, so I had a look at all my works, opuses. And I thought, oh my God, she's right. It's one work after the other. They are all inspired for. I said, what is it going to stop? Because even sort of in Beethoven, Mozart, it's not possible to have all great works. It's just not human.
Yes.
But I think that if you start to think about that, you end up not well psychologically.
Does the term classical music place obstacles in growing and attracting younger audiences?
No. I think that the obstacle is almost saying that there are obstacles. I think that it's a view on society. I think that it's depending on the society. I think that we are lacking in our societies. Maybe we are lacking in shame.
We're lacking shame in shame.
Shame, yes. Shame is a very good thing in some way. So let's say if you people think that if you were sort of you ask someone and the person is 20 years old, and she asks them, can you read and write? They'll say, of course, yes. Or if they can't, they'll feel really ashamed that they can't. But normally, you can read and write at that age. You're not. But on the other hand, you ask them, have they heard about Beethoven? And if they've not heard, they don't feel ashamed. But it should be the same shame as not knowing how to read or write. I think that after that, appreciation is something else. But first, there are knowledge of what has been great before, it's how you view it, sort of you should know things, like the same way that there's a minimum of mathematics that you should know, there's a minimum you should know how to read, write. Well, you should know who are the greatest people that have lived in the past first.
Yes.
And but I think that it's possible sort of and maybe I'm not answering your question totally. I think that it's possible that also the fact that contemporary music has not been very great, in my view, in the past 60 years about, I think that when I was young, for me, I really loved new things. Like, for me, when I was 6 or 7 years old, I was super excited the first time I heard of Stravinsky or Schoenberg. Or it was super exciting, but it was not less than Mozart. It was very great. But people like Boulez, Xenakis, they are pygmies to these people. They don't belong in the same category. I think that maybe sort of there is that, because young people, you know, in the young, there is something, there are two elements it's the same element that can lead to great things or terrible things.
Yes.
You can have the young people following sort of, because they are intense, following sort of great political movement like they were the Nazi youth or sort of, you know, with Mao Zedong, sort of terrible things, because they are easily sort of
influenced.
Influenced, but not only that, they see the world as black and white, and they are willing to give it all, and they've not experienced, which is good, death, or so the world is extreme. But on the other hand, they've got something. There's something good in youth, is that you are looking for something new, and that is something positive as well.
Yes.
And I think that if you don't provide the young with something new for long enough, maybe it plays also a role in creating when I was young, I don't know how it was in England because I grew up in France, but the term classical music didn't exist. There was basically music, which was what we call classical music now, and there was the rest that was sort of entertainment, basically. And that was how it was called, which makes complete sense, because if you think about it, we call classical music something that is anything but classical. sort of, you know, it's like we started to call sort of, I don't know, Picasso classical painting, but we don't do that. It's weird. Sort of to call Stravinsky classical, or I don't know, Wagner classical, it's sort of such, it's weird. It's it just doesn't belong. So it's like calling a cat a dog. Okay, they are both animals, but they're not the same animal. So I think that because of that, sort of the young feel that it's there is a classical music that is music of the past, and there is something else. But what they don't see is that during the time of the Mozart, there was the pop music. It's just that didn't was not worth very much, and that was just easy. It's just that it was a different time, and there were not the media sort of the production of sound. But it's not that there's always artistic music and music that is commercial. There's in any time, but it, I think that is the role of school.
Yes.
Of just, you shouldn't come out of school. When I think about it, you know, people go to school, they are, depending on which country, but let's say from age 6 till you are age 18. And you, so that's quite a few years. I mean, that's more than 10 years. And you go to school 8 months a year or something like that. So that's many, many days. Even if you learned the name of, just the name of one great composer, one great painter, one great writer, one great scientist, every week you should come out of at 18 knowing what who were the great people in humanity for the past 2,000 years. It's not so difficult.
Yes.
There are not that many.
Yes.
But we don't do that, so people are just not aware that it's there. It's because you don't have a choice then. If you don't know that it exists, you don't have a choice. So I think the biggest obstacle is to actually is making a really, really big effort to try to bring the young. So just, but not in not making. It's not that you need to change.
It needs to be supplemented. I from the way you've said. Actually, if you look at the education systems around the world, they need drastic changes. I want to go on about the recording experience of your piano your piano concerto that you really recently did with the Royal Philharmonic. We're going to listen to that next, and you wrote and had it played by Cecilia. Is it or Cecilia?
Kilia.
Kilia, thank you. Irozun. And I wanted to ask, does this mean that you're changing your pencil for a baton, or is conducting now a supplement to your musicianship and a further development?
It's not new. It's just that it's definitely not a change. It's just that when I was younger, in my 20s, I did conducting as well. But at that point, had I chosen to do more conducting, you know, when you're 20, the agents would have wanted me to take everything. And then I didn't want to have a life like Mahler, where you could compose only during the summer, because during the year, you had just too much work. And that I didn't want. And that's for the same reason that I didn't become a violinist as a soloist. You need a lot of time to compose. So I always conducted. It's just that now I'm more, I think, it's thanks to my wife. She said, you know, now you're a well-known composer. Maybe you can pick and choose more or do more conducting. For me, I think that it's, I like doing it. And it's quite important for me to give performances of my works that fit state, because we are lucky these days we record things. So that's because I found that it tells a lot. If a work of mine, the conductor can listen to it when I've conducted it, it helps them. And then I find it really useful, that part, and also I just like doing it. But again, in what I like to arrive to is a balance of maybe 30 concerts a year, which is for a conductor would not be enough. Professional conductors give many more concerts than that, but for me that would be the limit. but with a nice project, nice orchestra, that would be good, because I think twice a month it's okay.
What are the next projects coming up for you as far as your conducting is concerned?
You need a project, so I'm conducting in London in June, then in July I'm conducting in Finland. That will be nice, because I think Finland in the winter, personally it's a nightmare, because I don't like the minus 25 on dark. But I've never been to Finland in the summer, and there's a really beautiful,
it's beautiful
out there.
Yes.
So I'm doing my cello concerto, and we are doing also some Elgar and some Sibelius, of course. And then I come back and I go to Italy, and my wife is Italian, so we'll do a sort of maybe a follow-up holiday there. And then I'm conducting in a festival in Larici, which is sort of on the coast, and apparently it's very beautiful. I've been to Italy in many places, but not there. And that's the Toscanini Philharmonic, and I'm doing Mahler 4th Symphony, and then again my cello concerto. And after that, so that's the immediate thing. And then I've got a project I've got a new collaboration with the English Chamber Orchestra, and we are looking together to record a CD next season.
Oh, so a lot of exciting projects coming up. Nimrod, thank you so much for your time and your conversation today. I wish you everything of the best for a very good summer. And we're going to continue now listening to your concerto for piano and orchestra, Opus 91. I think you wrote in 2021, and a recording made with the Royal Philharmonic, with you on the podium.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. We've just heard Nimrod Borenstein and the Concerto for Piano and Orchestra, Opus 91, with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and the pianist Klekilia Irozun.